Book lovers, welcome to the Book Club at 91.7. I'm Mark Purcell. Good morning. Hope you had a happy Halloween. Ghosts and goblins are lingering into the Saturday morning as Teresa Argee shares stories of America's most haunted in just a moment. I'll talk with Ransom Riggs about his creepy photo collection and inspiration for Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. And later, Brad Ricca, who is coming to the Fort Thomas branch of the Campbell County Public Library next week, shares the story of the Superboys who created Superman and their decades-long battle for legal rights to their hero. But this show is more than just conversations with writers. The Book Club at 91.7 listens to readers as well. A collection of readers sharing their scariest books coming up later. But right off the bat, here's what some of your friends are reading.
Hi, I'm Deborah Crombie, and I am from McKinney, Texas. I am actually rereading a Dick Francis novel from the 1990s called To the Hilt, which is partly set in Scotland, and I love the characters, and I love the setting and the plotting and the character descriptions. It's just great reading.
Georgia McLean, and I'm from Georgetown, Ohio, and I just finished reading No Impact Man last night. And it's a really good book. It makes you think about the amount of waste that even the people who think they're doing good things for the environment are really are creating the waste and the carbon footprint. And so the guy tries to make no impact on the earth for an entire year. No carbon, no trash. He even turns his electricity off. He ends up realizing the effect that convenience that we purchase every day has on our lives and what culture forces us to do. And are we really happy with the life that we live this way with all this convenience? So it's a good book.
Hello, I'm Michael Link from Northside, and right now I'm reading Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel. This book, it's a post-apocalyptic novel for adults who don't read post-apocalyptic novels. It's incredibly well written. It jumps forward and back, telling narratives from different characters' perspectives, both before this influenza outbreak, the Georgian flu, and after, and how these characters from different points along the timeline of this epidemic find their way through their individual lives.
This is the Book Club at 91.7. I'm Mark Purcell. Hope you had a good Halloween last night, and those Halloween treats continue this morning on the Book Club as I talk with Teresa Argee, who, along with Eric Olson, has put out the book America's Most Haunted, The Secrets of Famous Paranormal Places. So we're going to keep the creepiness going on this Saturday morning, the day after Halloween, with a talk with Teresa. Welcome to the Book Club at 91.7.
Well, thanks for having me.
I wanted to ask, first off, with America's Most Haunted, The Secrets of Famous Paranormal Places, whether you intended this to be a travel book or more like an information book for the hauntings around the country, because I could see it going either way, Teresa.
Well, actually, our intention was to make it a little bit of both. We wanted to appeal to both the paranormal enthusiasts, the ghost hunters, the hobbyists, but also those who like to travel. As somebody like myself who travels a lot for this type of business to explore these haunted locations, I mean, I even make my family vacations centered around a haunted location, if at all possible. You know, sometimes there's just not enough information out there, even with the internet. So we wanted to kind of have it where it could be appeal to those who are just interested in travel, those who are interested in history, because we're very heavy on the history, and those who are interested in haunted locations and ghosts.
Well, you go to various locations around the country. Have you found in your investigations that there is any particular corner of the country that might be more haunted than others?
Well, I personally think that the eastern part of the United States is more haunted, but quite frankly, I think I'm a little bit biased because I am from Ohio. I'm from the North Coast, as they call it here.
Yes.
And obviously, I've been to places closer to my area more often. So some could say that I am biased because of where I live, and that's true. But I also think it has something to do with the age of the country. The eastern part of the United States was obviously the first settled by white settlers, and there's a lot of history in those areas. And it seems, and I did live in California for 5 years, so I think I can speak on this, the East Coast and the eastern part of the United States seems to embrace their history a little bit more and works to preserve it. Whereas further west, at least in my experience, they like everything brand spanking new and shiny. And if a building is 20 years old, to them it seems like it's old. Where in places in New England, they have buildings that are hundreds of years old. So I think that might have something to do with it. Not that a new building can't be haunted, but I think that the whole eeriness and the lore just seems to be celebrated a little more where places are embracing their history.
There are so many places that you include in America's Most Haunted, the book, that I wanted to visit, but I have to pare myself down to just a few. So I decided to stick closer to home, because you do have quite a few locations in Ohio that and nearby areas that were haunted, and mostly buildings with very historic, well, both good and bad history, I guess. And we'll begin down in Louisville with the Waverly Hills Sanatorium. That was where thousands of patients died at the height of the tuberculosis epidemic in the early 1900s. And this is quite a haunted establishment.
Waverly Hills Sanatorium was probably the one place that was tops on my list, on my paranormal bucket list, as I call it, of places that I wanted to go and explore. Even before I started writing the book, there's only actually two places in the book that I specifically went to for the book. I had been to the rest, either had experiences previously in these places or not. And Waverly Hills was one that I had been to twice before I started writing the book. And once was for a television show that we did, and once was just kind of a follow-up visit. And Waverly Hills was an eye-opener for me. A place like that, a tuberculosis hospital, was something I was not that familiar with. And when I started digging into the history, and I did a little bit for the television show, but more so when we started writing the book, when you think about tuberculosis, this is not something that I knew much about, but back in the 30s and the 40s, this was something that affected everyone in the United States, everyone in the world, actually. You either knew somebody who had tuberculosis, a family member had tuberculosis. It was rampant. It was an epidemic. And even to this day, there are still over 1 million deaths a year from tuberculosis in other countries. So these tuberculosis hospitals before antibiotics were everywhere in the United States. And Waverly Hills was supposed to be, for Jefferson County, like the state of the art. It was supposed to be the place where they could do the most good. But unfortunately, before antibiotics, they were just treating symptoms. They couldn't cure it. And people died, and thousands of people died, and people who treated people who had tuberculosis died. It's very, very sad. And Waverly Hills, as creepy as the building is, as haunted as the building is, it really was a place of hope. It was the last hope for these people, and they went trying to live out their lives with a little bit of dignity. Unfortunately, it didn't really do much to help the suffering. So it was a very, very sad, sad place.
America's Most Haunted, The Secrets of Famous Paranormal Places, the book by Teresa Argy and Eric Olson. I'm talking with Teresa this morning on the Book Club at 91.7. And I did notice a theme that many of these haunted places are places where the people came to an untimely end. The tuberculosis that wiped out families, women, men, children of all ages. But there's also where I guess you would say a little bit of the reputation came from the people who stayed there. And I'm thinking about the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum in Weston, West Virginia. And this is a place that is big among paranormal enthusiasts, because I was just taking the ghost tour at Music Hall here in Cincinnati last week, and they brought up the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum. Talk about that place.
Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum is in Weston, West Virginia, and this was actually built right during the very beginning of the Civil War. And unfortunately, as they were building it, the Civil War came, literally marched into Weston, and the troops took over the building, and it became a camp. It was actually a camp for these soldiers before it even opened as an asylum. But when you think about a place like Trans-Allegheny, back before there were hospitals, back before there were social services, people didn't know what to do with people who had mental illness. They thought it was witchcraft. They thought it was a crime. they didn't know how to treat these people, so they used to just lock them up, literally, in prisons. And there was a big reformation in the United States. It actually started in Europe and came over to the United States, and Dorothea Dix was kind of the forerunner of this movement to try and get people who had mental illness treated as people who were sick and were deserving of dignity and help. And so places like Trans-Allegheny, once the Civil War finally passed, were designed to help these people. And it actually has a very interesting architecture that was supposed to aid in the treatment of the mentally ill. Just to have a pleasing aesthetic was supposed to be helpful in their treatment. But unfortunately, again, like many good ideas, it started off as a great idea, a great place, someplace to help these people so they weren't locked away in prisons, so they weren't just forgotten about. But it became a dumping ground for the unwanted. And back then, pretty much you could commit someone in your family to a lunatic asylum or a place like this for any reason. Husbands could drop their wives off just because they disagreed with them on an argument. So there was many reasons you could be sent to Trans-Allegheny, and it didn't take long before these places were very overcrowded, completely understaffed and underfunded. So they themselves became a sort of prison for these poor people that really had no place else to go. And I think that's one of the reasons that fueled the hauntings. And Trans-Allegheny was notorious for giving lobotomies. And this, it wasn't just Trans-Allegheny, many places were, but the Western State Hospitals, it was called at one point, there was a doctor who his only job was to go around from these hospital to hospital to hospital just doing lobotomy after lobotomy after lobotomy. And this was to keep the patients so they could actually deal with them, because many of them were out of control and they were very hard to deal with. It was to keep them compliant and complacent and quiet. And it was just really horrible. And when you have so many patients and so little staff, you're going to have all sorts of atrocities happening, not just with their treatment, but patient-on-patient violence and murder and rape. It became a horrible, horrible place. And I think that's one of the reasons why this place is so very haunted, and it's very high up there on the list of super haunts in the United States.
Well, as a person known for being a paranormal investigator, I imagine access to some of these places might be a little easier than others, but did you have any of these places in your book, America's Most Haunted, that you found difficult to access?
Well, I was pretty lucky that since I've been doing this for so long, and I had been to many of these places before I had even started the book with Eric. A couple places, just because of their distance, kind of far away, like Iowa and Colorado, places that I had never been to. I kind of had to rely on research and people that I really respect to give me their information about these places. But it was really kind of a wonderful thing that once I reached out, and there was only a couple places that I reached out to during the book. I reached out to Willoughby Cole, but because of my personal history with the place and my relationship with the owner, I did not have any problems getting in there.
Well, that is one place I wanted to ask you about, because I was quite intrigued when reading about it in America's Most Haunted, The Secrets of Famous Paranormal Places, this Willoughby Cole and Garden Center in Willoughby, Ohio. And that's kind of home base for you, right?
It is. I live not far from Willoughby in Northeast Ohio. And what's different about this place, besides it's basically completely unknown, the only time this place has been on television was I did a show called The Marriage Ref a few years ago, and we actually did a little investigation at Willoughby Cole, but, I mean, you only saw it for a second. This is a working store. This is a hardware store. It's an old coal company. It is not a paranormal place. It is not a place that's open for ghost hunting, per se. It is not a place that has tried to market their hauntings at all. But for us, it's a place that was on the ghost walk. And when I say us, I mean me and Kathy Weber. This is my ghost hunting partner. She's been with me on all my adventures. And she has a business called the Willoughby Ghost Walk. And it is a guided historic walking tour through the town of Willoughby. And Willoughby Cole is one of the places that we go to. And she investigated this place for her book, Haunted Willoughby, Ohio, and did extensive research, because basically it was where the city was almost kind of founded from this property, kind of sprung up around it. And through her research, she put this on the ghost walk, and through her, I got many times to go in there and do investigations. So that was one place that was different from all the rest because it was not trying to make a reputation of their hauntings and their ghosts or try to make money off it. Because honestly, paranormal investigators can flock to these places and give them money, but they're not going to come to Willoughby Cole and buy cement. It's just really, their ghosts don't, it doesn't help their business to be haunted. So they just open it with the, out of the goodness of their heart. They let us come in here and explore, and we tell them the findings, and we're just trying to save the building and keep the property going.
And there's a Rod Serling connection, do I understand?
Absolutely. Anybody who's a fan of The Twilight Zone, the original Twilight Zone, might remember an episode called Next Stop Willoughby. And this was about a businessman in New York who lived a very hectic life and was very unhappy. He was successful but very unhappy, and he would fall into these dream states on the train ride home. And in his dreams, he would wake up in this idyllic little town called Willoughby. And Rod Serling based this episode on Willoughby, Ohio, a place that he'd never been there, but he had passed through it all the time, and he had heard about it, just a quaint little town. And it's a really unique episode, not super spooky, but really intriguing. And Willoughby embraces this notoriety tremendously. When you see this episode and you see the town of Willoughby and how small town it is and how happy the people are and how they're just very welcoming, that is really what Willoughby is. And that is what Willoughby Cole is. As scary as it is, as haunted as this building is, it is still a very welcoming place. It's really creepy inside, though, but it's a very welcoming place, and we thank Rod Serling for putting us on the map.
Take a terrifying tour of the nation's most haunted houses, hospitals, and historic places, including Willoughby Cole, in the book America's Most Haunted, The Secrets of Famous Paranormal Places, written by Teresa Argy and Eric Olson. Teresa Argy, thanks for spending some time with me this morning on the Book Club at 91.7.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. You know, I used to go to school in Cincinnati, so I'm kind of a hometown girl there. I spent a few years in the 80s down in Cincinnati in college.
Well, we may have a few haunted places around here for you to check out, too.
So. Oh, I'm very well aware of them. I'd love to come down and explore them. Maybe for the next book, I'll get down to Music Hall.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. Thanks again, Teresa.
Thank you.
Book Club producer Kevin Reynolds and I were talking the other day, and he pointed out the plethora of plays being staged in Cincinnati that had roots in books. Ensemble Theater producing The Iliad. No Theater has Moby Dick. At Playhouse in the Park, it's I Love, I Lost, I Made Spaghetti, based on a memoir. And at Cincinnati Shakespeare Company, for one more week, The Birds, based on a short story by Daphne du Maurier. Here's part of the short story with the soundscape from the theater production. The wind seemed to cut him to the bone as he stood there uncertainly, holding the sack. He could see the white-capped seas breaking down under in the bay. He decided to take the birds to the shore and bury them. "The tide will take them when it turns," he said to himself. He looked out to sea and watched the crested breakers combing green. They rose stiffly, curled, and broke again, and because it was ebb tide, the roar was distant, more remote, lacking the sound and thunder of the flood. Then he saw them, the gulls, out there, riding the seas. What he had thought at first to be the white caps of the waves were gulls. Hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands. They rose and fell in the trough of the seas, heads to the wind like a mighty fleet at anchor waiting on the tide. To eastward and to the west, the gulls were there. They stretched as far as his eye could reach, in close formation, line upon line. Had the sea been still, they would have covered the bay like a white cloud, head to head, body packed to body. Only the east wind, whipping the sea to breakers, hid them from the shore.
You see, once they're in,
we're talking about crows, seabirds, sparrows, robins. I mean, you think a man could... A grown adult can...
Yes, but your average gull is big. 4, 5, or 6 pounds in weight coming straight down out of the sky, easily reaching speeds of 40 miles an hour, can cause a tremendous amount of damage.
Thanks to the Cincinnati Shakespeare Company for the soundscape from their production of The Birds. The Birds, by Connor McPherson, from the short story by Daphne du Maurier, directed by Brian Isaac Phillips, will be on stage at Cincinnati Shakespeare Company tonight and tomorrow, and next Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, the final performances.
Details at wvxu.org. A visit to Miss Peregrine's home for peculiar children after a short break on the Book Club at 91.7.